Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Rochelle Rice's teleconference. My name is Rochelle Rice, and our guest this evening is Amy Pershing, talking about characteristics, complications, causes, and risks of binge eating disorder. Amy began her career at the Center for Eating Disorders in Ann Arbor in 1991, and she developed the BodyWise program in 1993 to serve a growing population of clients with binge eating disorder. Amy assumed the role of clinical director at the center in 1998. She and Shavice Turner, CEO and founder of the Binge Eating Disorder Association, joined forces to found Pershing's Turner Centers in Annapolis, Maryland in 2008. Amy, welcome to the call.
Thank you, Rochelle. I appreciate you inviting me.
You know, this has been a subject that I've wanted to address for quite some time. As you know, I work a lot with the movement with women, but there's been so many changes when it comes to the eating disorders. So I guess before we begin, maybe you could tell us a little bit of your story, why you're so passionate about this topic.
Absolutely. I would be happy to. I had an eating disorder from a pretty young age. I was, but there wasn't really a name for it.
Yeah.
And by the time I got any treatment, which was after college, actually there still wasn't a name for it. The only thing I got that was close to a name was I was called one time a failed bulimic because I didn't purge.
Okay.
But really what was true is I had a long relationship with binge eating. Mm-hmm. And with hiding food and with thinking about food all the time. I was very focused on my weight and on keeping my weight down, but what I also knew was that food played a tremendously larger role in my life than food was designed to play.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to it to do all kinds of things, to soothe, to protect, to give me a place of my own, to break the rules, to express my feelings, to check out, all kinds of things that food is not really designed to do. But that was my coping mechanism, my best friend, and also my nemesis.
Mm. So even though we've named it, the symptoms or the reasons are still the same after all these years even.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah. Well, we're seeing a lot now, the changes with the naming of the overeating or the binge eating disorder and the DSM manual. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in terms of how this change is coming about and what that means.
It's actually a really exciting change, particularly for someone like me and a whole lot of people like
mm-hmm.
me who have struggled with this issue, and it didn't have a name.
Right.
So, you know, we had anorexia nervosa and we had bulimia nervosa that had a name, but this really didn't have a name. And over the course of my career, so I feel particularly fortunate to be a witness to this,
yeah.
People in the treatment community have come together and said, wait a minute, there's another eating disorder here.
Mm-hmm.
And so what over time and a tremendous amount of effort and research and clinical pressure and all kinds of lobbying, basically what we've been able to do is to get binge eating disorder into the diagnostic and statistical manual that comes out next year. And it will be included among the other eating disorders. And that actually has tremendous implication because what it means is there's much greater legitimacy for binge eating disorder as a disorder requiring treatment, much like any other eating disorder. So it brings a considerable amount of hope to a whole lot of people who have not been able to get insurance coverage for services or who haven't been able to get coverage for inpatient or residential treatment. So it can have very far-reaching implications for the many people who struggle with BED.
Hope even in the fact that there's a name for this thing as opposed to being shamed for it.
Absolutely.
Mm.
Absolutely. And
yeah.
I think one of that is a particularly important issue because historically, before binge eating disorder really was understood as an eating disorder, it was really understood as a question of willpower. With our dieting culture, the implication is that if you can't stick to a diet, you don't have willpower.
Mm.
And so the idea being that somehow binging is under the control of someone and they're simply being weak-willed. And what we have always felt to be true, and now we have research and a great deal of clinical wisdom that says, indeed, that is not the case and that this is an eating disorder that requires professional treatment.
Yeah, so with that, let's talk a little bit now about the characteristics of binge eating or overeating. Can you help us with a few of those?
Sure. Maybe it would help just to start with the way BED is going to be characterized in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. I think that gives us sort of a rough idea of how to define it. So some key things. One is the most important thing is that someone with binge eating disorder feels absolutely out of control during a binge. They do not feel able to stop. They typically eat much more rapidly than normal, so there's a sense of trying to get in as much food as quickly as possible. They eat until they feel typically very uncomfortably full, often eating large amounts of food when they're not physically hungry. Most people, when they binge alone, so it's an isolative kind of experience with food. They don't tend to binge around other people. And then there's also a lot of guilt or shame or disgust or even depression that's associated with the binge behaviors. The DSM will, in order to have the diagnosis of binge eating disorder, the DSM will require that binges happen twice a week over the course of 6 months. So that's what the diagnosis is going to look like.
Mm-hmm. And is that all self-evaluated, obviously, right? That the patient that has to say, yes, I do this 2 times a week, and it's been a minimum of 6 months?
Correct. And the diagnostic criteria actually are intentionally kind of vague because the way a binge is defined is very different from one person to the next. I know a binge can vary tremendously in the same person. So sometimes a binge might be a handful of cookies, and another time it might be a whole pizza. So it can vary tremendously. Much more what we want to look at is the person's feelings of disgust or guilt or shame around the experience.
What are some of the complications with this, Amy? What do you feel are some of the complications with this disorder of disordered eating, I guess we should say?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of complications that can go with it, certainly. And again, it depends on the person. But we see all different kinds of impacts. I mean, certainly one of them is if you're living with a chronic sense of shame, that can lead to all kinds of mood disorders, anxiety disorders. People often struggle with depression, so that can be a co-occurring issue. So we want to look for those kinds of concerns. A lot of times people who are dealing with binge eating disorder may, in fact, be carrying extra weight on their body, not necessarily. So some people with BED may be, quote, overweight. Some may indeed not be, and certainly not everybody who our culture deems as overweight has binge eating disorder by any means. But what it can mean is that sometimes people are moving around in the world in a body that doesn't feel authentic and that's actually carrying more weight than is its comfort level. People often struggle with low self-esteem. They feel really badly about themselves and the world, and they get those messages a great deal from the culture as well. A lot of times people who deal with binge eating disorder have other co-occurring issues, we call them, that they're dealing with. They may be dealing with obsessive-compulsive disorder, or they may be dealing, like I said, with depression or other kinds of mood disorders. They often have a very significantly negative body image, regardless of weight. So there really are tremendous implications, not only the binge eating, but the ramifications from the binge eating that impact people most of their lives.
Yeah, I often say this is a multi-layered, multifaceted situation we have here, and it's so hard to even figure out, in a sense, where to begin. Where does one begin? Let's talk a little bit about some of the risk factors maybe associated with the binge eating.
Yeah, and what's interesting is as the research is coming in right now, we're really just piecing together what are all the possible factors and are they the same across the board. So what research is continuing to suggest more and more is that indeed there's a very strong genetic component. Binge eating disorder seems to run in families. So we're thinking, okay, well how does that play out? Does everyone who struggles with binge eating have that genetic piece? We really don't know that for sure, but that certainly seems to be a component of it. There's often a family history of other eating disorders, including anorexia and bulimia. So we want to pay attention to that. There's often a family history of depression or alcoholism or other addictions or OCD. Often there's an intense family concern with weight and appearance. So that can be a factor. And again, these are all possible but not necessary factors. So it's different for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
We also see a higher rate of significant emotional trauma or loss, including things like physical and sexual and emotional abuse. A lot of my clients have struggled with trauma early in their lives, so that certainly seems to be connected for some people to the development of a binge eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
We also see, like we see with other eating disorders, a high degree of perfectionism or black and white thinking, kind of a sense of either I get it exactly right or it's bad. So that's something we think about too. There also seems to be a genetic predisposition to experiencing feelings particularly intensely for some people with binge eating disorder. They're especially sensitive, and I don't mean that in a negative way by mm-hmm. any means, but I mean it kind of like this. They are able often to walk into, say, a room full of their family members and pretty fast sense what's going on emotionally in that room. So their sensors are excellent, actually.
Mm-hmm.
There can often be, too, a tendency towards self-soothing or checking out. So that's also sometimes a person's knee-jerk reaction with binge eating disorder is to try to soothe both themselves, actually, and other people. They tend to be caretakers.
Mm-hmm.
Another way I sometimes talk about my clients is their role in the family was often the oldest child, regardless of birth order. In other words, they were kind of, you know, maybe 10 going on 40.
Right.
Often very responsible. So those are some of the things that can play as risk factors.
Yes. And it's interesting, too, because you talk about, you know, the predisposition or the genetic predisposition, which is something so interesting because I would never even thought of in terms of the genetics were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's some of my clients have even expressed, like, they can even feel when they feel. Even the food up is high when they're having that sort of acid reflux kind of GERD feeling, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm trying to tiptoe into this idea of the amount of food being in without shaming a client. Any thoughts on that in terms of what could also be happening physically? I mean, I imagine the acid from the stomach and the esophagus and things like that when it comes to binging.
In terms of the physical symptoms?
Even problems we could be facing.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are a whole host of them. Certainly acid reflux and GERD are significant problems sometimes for people. People with BED often have food allergies that seem to have developed as a result of their binging. So that's, you know, they didn't have them prior to having the eating disorder. We don't know if that link is causal, but it does seem to at least exacerbate perhaps allergies that may already have existed. So we don't know. Again, we don't really know the long-term effects of chronic significant overeating. So it is tough to tell, but, you know, I've certainly seen my clients have all kinds of esophageal problems, stomach problems, not to mention joint and muscle problems,
mm-hmm.
Because if their body is carrying weight that's not authentic to their body, that can be particularly problematic as well. So there are all kinds of symptoms mm-hmm. that people carry. I've had people have problems with their teeth because they may be binging and not brushing their teeth afterward. You know, I mean, it can certainly be manifest in all kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm. Because often, too, my clients will talk about the puffiness they feel, the sluggishness. So there's also this whole host of these physical characteristics that we're talking about. The physical body is feeling as well as the emotional side.
Absolutely. And one of the side effects, although, you know, some people call it a side effect, and I call it actually an intended effect typically, is that after a person has binged, because their body is doing the vast majority of its energy is being expended to digest the food, they're not able to think, they're not able to focus, they feel very lethargic, they just typically want to lay down. And I think sometimes that effect of a binge is actually sought, if not consciously, kind of preconsciously, because it becomes a way for somebody who is otherwise profoundly overextended in the world to take a break.
and kind of give them permission to take a break then, right? I mean, they've kind of moved their body into this place where you have to take a break.
That's right. That's exactly right. There's no option.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting, Amy, coming to this, you and I with an eating disorder and how passionate we are about helping others with this eating disorder, yet we both know there's still so much shame around this disorder. So let's talk a little bit about the shame that's involved with this and how we can, you know, help women get off of this cycle of shame, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the shame cycle, I think it's good how I think about it, is really, really powerful. One way that cycle can play out is because there's so much pressure for women for their bodies to look a certain way, women and girls, I should say, because certainly this starts much younger than adulthood. So women or girls feel shame at their body, so they try to intervene in some way to change it. So typically that involves some kind of calorie restrictive diet. Mm-hmm. What we know is that, among many other things, one of the things that can trigger binge eating is restrictive dieting, because as soon as your body doesn't know the difference between a diet and a famine. And so as soon as you're under-eating what the amount of food that your body actually needs, it begins to obsess about food and think about where it's going to get food naturally.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, when we've under-eaten, we're going to eat quickly when we are around food. We're not really going to be connected to that fullness cue that we would otherwise hear, and so we're just going to be eating food as quickly as we can. So typically what happens is dieting results in binging, and that results in overeating, and that triggers binging because the person is so hungry. They typically also beat themselves up for once again failing on their diet, and that further pushes them into, oh, the heck with it, I've already blown it. They start eating again. They start binging again. Then they feel even more shame and even worse about their body, and then they vow to do something about it, and they go back on a diet, and we go through the cycle over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Shame is fundamentally toxic. There's really only a few situations in which shame is appropriate. Social shame can be appropriate in certain situations because it keeps us from harming each other. But internal shame, shame about the worth and value of the self, is a toxic experience. It's something that we will do anything to avoid. And so there isn't ever really any benefit that comes from shame. And in fact, it makes a person even more likely to want to check out. And so that reinforces the need for a binge, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So shame is certainly one of the worst contributors to keeping a binge eating disorder going.
Mm. You know, do you find that when a woman comes to you or you know, seeks treatment, that once they are, you know, once it's named, it meaning, let's just say, the elephant in the room, the eating disorder is named, what type of a reaction do we, is there a sense of relief of saying, okay, this is what I have? Is there a sense of checking out even more? Or is this vary from, obviously, maybe from person to person?
I think typically the one piece of good news first, just to say, is more often now I have women calling, and men and women calling and saying, I'm dealing with binge eating disorder. So the good news is more people actually are aware of it as a thing that they need to get help to resolve, mm-hmm. than ever before. But they're certainly still by far and away the minority. Most people come in essentially saying, I don't know what's wrong with me. I just can't seem to stick to my diet. I just keep going and eating and eating and eating, and I cannot seem to stop. And so when we're able to give that a name and we're able to talk about how it's very possible that their genes are, as the metaphor goes, a gun, right? That in fact they are predisposed, mm-hmm. to go to food for these various different reasons, that's mm-hmm. a possibility in their makeup, and that there's all of these other ways that food has worked for them.
Mm-hmm.
It allows them to begin to develop some compassion. And what I've found for myself, it's taken a long while to get here, but I'm actually very grateful for having had an eating disorder because it saved my life. And so I think that's one of the ways that, or one of the journeys that I try to help my clients to come to, is to begin to appreciate and understand why the eating disorder was essential to their survival and that it isn't anymore.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting point, essential to the survival at a particular time in one's life.
Right.
But then it comes a place where the skills can be brought in to manage what's happening.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's fascinating. I really, really like that a lot. I think that, you know, it's interesting because I keep going back to the shame piece because I think, too, a lot of my clients, you know, when the discussion does come up, that they think they either, A, they're the only ones that are doing this or that they're shame at being home alone doing this. You know, so people seem to feel happy, or not happy, because that's too strong. Women seem to feel less isolated when they have this information of, you know, this is going on in the world. Do you find that groups do well together, or?
I definitely do. Yeah, we do at both of our center locations. We do support groups and we do therapy groups. I wish Rochelle, you could carbon copy yourself and, you know.
I'll come down.
Would you? That would be great. Because we do try to have movement as much as we can be a part of movement groups so that women have a safe place to move. You know all about that. I think for women to have, again, men and women, younger and older, to have a place where they talk about, you know, how they've been planning a binge all day in their head, and they come home and it feels like there's a place where they're finally safe and the pressure's let down, and they see these nods around the room. You know, that people really understand the nature of that relationship with food. There's no shaming, there's no blaming, there's no attack in any way or a suggestion that there's a lack of willpower or a weakness. That's profoundly healing.
Yeah. If I could just interrupt for one moment and ask the people on the line to *6 to mute their line, I would really appreciate that. Thank you. *6. Amy, so you touched on the movement piece. Let's bring that in just a little bit because, of course, you know it's my favorite subject.
Sure.
So let's talk about how this works in relationship to the – let's talk about this a little bit more in relationship to the binge eating. Do you find that this, see, for me, when I see a person start to move and move their body, that there's a little more connection, obviously, with the body and with the breath, and sort of helps to sort of neutralize some of that, the emotion that might be charged up in there?
Absolutely. I think one of the things, too, when you have, you know, when shame is so much a part of a person's experience, and particularly for clients who've been abandoned emotionally or have been abused in some kind of way, one of the ways that they survive is to disconnect from the truth of their body, from the stories that their body tells. And so a significant part of healing is reconnecting with that body, and with their body, and learning those stories. And so part of that is about dealing with history. Part of it is about dealing with hunger and fullness. And part of it is about dealing with the different ways that they learn their body wants to move. So I know that one of my own developments that was so powerful for me was to see women of different shapes and sizes moving.
Mm-hmm.
That was so powerful for me to see, wow, there is tremendous beauty in any size person who's moving in integrity. It was really quite stunning to me, and so it gave me permission to explore what are the different kinds of movements that my body wants to do, that it calls on me to do. So I think generally speaking, that's a really significant and tough often part of the process for people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it starts with something as deceptively simple as breath work and just feeling their breath in their body.
Right. It's interesting you bring up the breath, too, because I've talked a lot with my clients about, you know, either, you know, inhaling their food, we'll say, or we've done a program called Breathe and Eat, where there's truly a lack of breath while one is eating.
Mm-hmm.
Or so that they're, like I said, either inhaling the food, which is kind of an interesting way of talking about it, or the other part is that there's just no sensation because the breath is just completely cut off. Do you notice this as part of some of the process work that you do, or?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think clients use those words for sure about, you know, I like you said, I inhale the food, or, you know, of just not have, because the food is almost always metaphor,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, for the rest of their relationship with their body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a sense of, first of all, breathing slows them down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
you know, so that there's sort of a sense of, okay, let's really connect here with what my body's asking. What does that sound like? And if they've been disconnected for a very long time, the cues can be very elusive and very subtle. And so that breath work is a very powerful way of doing something that's absolutely natural and that their body intrinsically tells them when they need to do it,
right.
that they can listen to and feel a sense of success.
Right. Yes, like I said, I really enjoy that. I find that the movement and the breath just helps so much in just helping her connect to her body and hopefully keep things a little more peaceful as she goes home after the class.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Amy, some people call it disordered eating, which I really like, this idea of irregular eating or disordered eating. Does that resonate with women at all in terms of that versus a binge eating? Or do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think to me, and I don't, maybe this is just a kind of a clinical distinction, so I don't know if this is a kind of a more general distinction. Mm-hmm. I make something of a distinction between disordered eating and binge eating disorder in the sense that if someone's dealing with disordered eating, sometimes there's a lot of other stuff going on behind that for them, but often there isn't. So you know, that relationship with food for bingers is often a fair amount more about disconnection and about using the relationship with food to deal with a whole variety of different kinds of emotional needs.
Okay, well, I'll definitely
and
start out
disordered eating is less so.
I'll definitely start
I think
out
most people I know who don't have an eating disorder have some form of disordered eating.
Right.
You know, they don't listen to their body cues very well, or they eat foods that don't really feel very good, or you know. So I think about it as kind of if we think about it as a continuum with a full blown binge eating disorder on one end, and disordered eating maybe closer to the other. Does that make sense?
Yes, and you bring up an interesting point too, because I'm sure you have cases where you've got, should we say, compounded eating disorders, meaning you got a binge eater with and a bulimic in one person, perhaps?
Sure.
Yeah.
Eating disorders can go through all kinds of different phases. In one sense, making distinctions in some ways is kind of artificial.
Mm-hmm.
In extreme cases, that's not true. But for a lot of folks, they have different phases, actually. So when you begin to explore, they might have had a pretty restrictive phase, or they might have had a phase where they had some form of purging,
mm-hmm.
like excessive exercise, or maybe even some laxative or diuretic use. So often, you know, it's kind of the label that someone puts on themselves is whatever they're doing when they walk into your office. But typically when you talk about it, it's much grayer.
Mm-hmm. And Amy, what do you see as hope on the horizon for this whole treatment when it comes to the binge eating disorder? What is there in terms of hopes when it comes to this?
You know, I think there's actually a lot of hope, which is great to say. I don't know that I would have said that 10 years ago, but I think I can say that a lot now. I think for one thing, just starting on the cultural piece, I think slowly, we're starting to expand our notions of beauty, and we're starting to challenge some of the, I think about this, the example of I don't even remember the company, I think it might have been J. Crew, who was selling the padded bras to, you know, very young girls,
mm-hmm.
and there was an outcry to stop that.
Yes.
And I was really struck by that, that there really is, I think, an increasing knowledge in the culture that trying to make those kinds of attacks, really, on little girls' bodies is not okay, and it damages them in the long run. So I think that wisdom is beginning to take hold, and that's really encouraging to me. And then in addition, we're doing better research, and we're doing more research to find out about the genetics and to find out, well, you know, if we know that we do have that proverbial gun, what does that mean for treatment, and how can we incorporate that, and does that change our treatment approaches? I'm sure that it will as we go along. So I think there's very much good news there. And as we're giving more and more permission to people to understand and to have compassion for themselves as authentic, intuitive eaters, that is, more and more we realize diets don't work, not
right.
only for people without eating disorders,
mm-hmm.
but they just don't work. So, you know, study after study after study tells us that long-term dieting doesn't work. So I think more and more we sort of are finding out that, in fact, eating the way we knew how to eat before somebody told us we didn't know how to eat
is coming
around in the popular press more and more. So I'm actually very hopeful.
Oh, Amy, it's so great to hear the hope. I think that's what many, many women just are looking for, is that hope when it comes to what's on the, what's ahead in terms of eating disorders, not only identifying and the treatment of, but the hope is just a great way to end. So thank you very much.